50 seasons of New York Islanders hockey.
And the New York Islanders have won their fourth straight Stanley Cup.
A once-in-a-lifetime celebration.
Oh, my goodness, Ryan Pulock saved the game!
This is Talkin' Isles with Greg Picker and Corey Wright.
We welcome you into another edition of Talkin' Isles, the New York Islanders' official interview-based podcast. Greg Picker here, the Islanders radio color commentator, now joined alongside by the director of digital for the New York Islanders, Corey Wright. And Corey, we brought on Bruno Gervais this week to talk at Isles.
This was a lot of fun for me because Bruno Gervais, I think, was definitely a little bit more of your era of Islander fandom and kind of pre both of us working for the team. So I actually didn't know a lot about Bruno until we started doing the research for this episode. And it turns out he's a very interesting guy, very well-spoken guy, had a lot of great stories. Of course, all those broadcasters are pretty buttoned up when it comes to podcast appearances, but really fun to get some stories of the mid-2000s Islanders, the mid-2000s Bridgeport Sound Tigers, and really a whole lot more.
And here we will take it away with Bruno Gervais.
The Islanders control the draw. Streit lined it up. Feed Gervais. Steps up, shoots. He scores! Bruno Gervais led one goal. Not sure if that changed direction or not, but lately, Bruno has had a hot goal-scoring stick, and the Islanders lead it 1-0.
We now welcome in Bruno Gervais to the Talkin' Isles podcast. Bruno played 418 games in the National Hockey League, majority of those with the New York Islanders, 331 in the blue and orange. Bruno was a sixth round pick of the Islanders in 2003. And Bruno, we typically like to go way back to the start of players' career and even predating your junior days. You got to participate in the Quebec Pee Wee Hockey Tournament, best tournament in the world for those around age 12. What was that experience like?
Well, first of all, it's a nice seeing you guys. Thank you for having me on. It was a great experience, a little special. The way we approached it, we had on our team, we had Michael Menard was a player. He's actually my D partner. And his older brother, Yannick, was the coach. And the assistant coach was Mario Duhamel, who's now with the Arizona Coyotes. So he was the assistant coach then, really young guy, right? 22, 23 maybe. And the way our coach approached this tournament, we had a really good team, obviously, you know, making it and, you know, being accepted in this tournament. But they wanted to use that as a team bonding. And we actually ended up, they rented one cabin. And if I remember correctly, I think there was two bedrooms in that cabin. And they told the parents to just drop off the kids, go find a hotel, go do your thing. They were going to take care of us. So the entire team stayed in the cabin with about two bedrooms in there. And we played cards, ordered pizza really, really late at night. And actually, I think it's my first time playing a hockey game without any sleep the night before because we were just a bunch of kids. Had a great time. Didn't perform as well as we wanted, obviously. A little bit of lack of sleep. But it was you know, fun memories at that tournament.
Well, Bruno, shifting ahead to your junior days in Akati Bathurst, there's obviously some pretty strong Islander connections there. Noah Dobson won a Memorial Cup with the Teton a few years ago, but you know, you were the captain of that team, and to captain a team that had Patrice Bergeron on it is definitely a feather in one's cap. So what do you remember about playing in junior and, you know, playing with a very young Patrice Bergeron at the time?
I taught him everything. That's where he learned. No, it was great. I mean, for Patrice, he was just, you know, in these years, like I remember he played 1 year in that U18 league here in Quebec. The following year, he was playing with us in Bathurst. The year after, he was playing, you know, with the Bruins. And the year after, it was a lockout year, so he was playing in the AHL with Providence. But just a tremendous guy. Had a blast with him. He was a great guy. He came up, like, it was his second year. It was the first year didn't make the team when he got drafted. But the second year made the team, and he had a great year. I remember, you know, obviously he was on a power play unit, a power play that, you know, good success. So he was one of those players that was really mature about his game. And right at that moment, and Riyad Peyman was our coach, and Riyad Peyman was a lot on details and everything. And Patrice was really good at that. At that moment, he was about 5'10", I'd say 175 or something like that. And sometimes he put himself in, you know, vulnerable situation which you learn fast. Like obviously you get to the major, junior, and you know, guys are bigger, guys are stronger. And I remember that was the one thing about him. And then as the year went on, proved a ton on that. And then the following year he came back. I think he was 6'1", almost 200 pounds or over 200 pounds. Like he's the type of kid like, or can like even now as a really veteran leader of Boston Bruins, he puts in the work and he's so committed to everything that he does every day and is so well thought that he's one of those that just learns and learns every year and keeps, you know, getting better about the detail of the game. And you like right then, like he was a young 17-year-old, but was mature as hell. And he was involved in every, like really fast and everything that had to do about leadership and just the way he carried himself. It was a surprise that he made it right away, obviously being a second round pick. But he came to the camp his year just before he left for his first camp with the Bruins, and he was a different man. He was just a different player, and he just crushed that camp. Like, I remember, I think the first center squad game, the score was like 12-3, and he had like 9 goals. And everyone's like, what the heck happened with him? And he never came back. So here's why.
I'm sure on the power play with you, maybe a bit, 50 points in 72 games for yourself from the blue line in 02-03. You end up being drafted by the Islanders, and that draft is maybe the best draft that the NHL has ever seen in 2003. It was in Nashville. Did you get to attend that draft? And if so, any memories from that time in Nashville?
No, no, I didn't. I remember being in Bathurst and a couple of the scouts came. And obviously for me, I was late, born in October. So I was 18 that season, and that was my draft year. And that year, I think I scored somewhere, I think, 22 or 23 goals. So I had a really good year offensively. I was known to be like a shutdown defenseman. So I played against the best lines as well. I was the captain of my team at 18. So I had a lot of like little plus here for me, even though I was a late and even though I wasn't a big player, like at that time, I think I was 5'10", 5'11", maybe. And I still grew to like 6'1", but we were still in the years where I remember scouts coming and making me go through some physical testings and stuff like that. And at a couple of occasions, the scout would just tell me, he's like, damn, if you were 2 inch taller, like you'd be on our list, or you'd be a high draft pick or this and that. But that height and, you know, the size, like I wasn't a big defenseman. So that was a nick against me. So I remember that. And then my agent, the way they worked, like if you were listed in the first 3 rounds, he would take you. And then after that, it was up to you. It was up to the player. But you know, he wanted to make sure that, you know, you're aware that you might be drafted or you won't. And the draft ended up being the same night as my younger sister's graduation from high school. And she spent her entire like life going into hockey rinks, spending the day there because I was playing, and then my younger brother would play after, and then the travel and the tournaments and this and that. And it was always, you know, obviously with everything, all the travel, everything that she did was kind of put second. And I didn't want that to happen again, especially if I wasn't going to be drafted. So we actually stayed. We had a party. We attended she did her graduation. We were part of it as a family, celebrate that. So that was the most important thing that weekend. And I ended up going to the draft. That was the night of the first, you know, the first round and everything, obviously. But I remember getting a phone call the next day. It actually woke me up, and it was, the Islanders calling. It was Mario Saracino, calling, saying I got drafted by the Islanders. And Alan Walsh, my agent, called me and everything like that. So then I got on the computer and went to see the list and trying to figure out a little bit what happened. But that's how I learned I was drafted by the Islanders.
Well, your first professional experience with the Islanders would have been playing in Bridgeport in that 2004-2005 season. And I love going back through Getty when we try to prepare for these podcasts and just look at photos of guys. You know, you find some stuff every now and then. And I forgot that the Sound Tigers used to have those like electric blue jerseys. I'm so used to them being kind of that blue and orange. So take us back to some of those Bridgeport memories. What were your first impressions of Bridgeport? Who were some of the teammates that stood out on those teams for you?
Well, there's a ton. Obviously, when you take that jump and you first make it to the pros, it's a big change. You're on your own. I remember, you know, I rented a house in the first year. I lived with Steve Regeer from Medicine Hat. And he was a rookie as well. So we moved in together. I remember I made it there with my Dodge Shadow 93, which was my first car. It was a collar like dark green. We called it the tank. And I kept it with me for a couple months. Being pro and guys turned pro and they got those signing bonus and everything. So I got a lot of heat for it, but I was actually really happy. And now, but my dad convinced me when I first got my signing bonus to invest it instead of spending it on a car. We had that conversation about money and managing it and everything like that. So I kept my car as long as possible. And I was happy to take the heat for it. I thought it was a smart decision. I remember Chris Campoli too came up. He was a rookie as well. He was my partner. We played a lot together, so he was one of them. I remember having Richard Seeley as a captain, and he's actually a GM now in the AHL. So he was tremendous impact. And you need this. Richard Seeley was the example, and now I maybe understand how important it is to have quality veteran around your young players, even in like in a situation of an AHL team. You see sometimes some organization are going to love to just give everything to their young players, but I don't think that's the way to, the best way to develop, to have those quality veterans around, quality presence around those young guys. You need that. So he was a big impact for that. But you learn a lot. It's like you're trying to drink out of like a fireman's hose right there, like where you just, there's so much coming in, so much information, so much to learn with life and everything, moving on your own and all this stuff. So it's a fun experience. It's great. You grow real fast. And I was really happy to do it over there in Bridgeport and with the Islanders. And there's a lot of guys that I played with some of those years or some of those camps with Bridgeport. Then we broke into the NHL after that, that, you know, made it special.
Now, the one full year you spent in Bridgeport was 2004-05. Which was really a special year for the AHL because it was the NHL lockout. So there was a lot of talent that was definitely NHL level, guy like Patrice Bergeron, who we just talked about, that either couldn't play in the NHL yet or came back to the AHL after maybe a year in the National Hockey League. So did that feel more of a step up than maybe some guys would have thought at the AHL level because there was just so much talent that was there compared to a normal year?
It's hard to say because for me, it was my first year. So like, I didn't know any better about the pro level, but it was. And you talked with the guys that were there and you talked to the guys, you know, that experience a couple of years prior to that. It was really, really good hockey. We had a couple of guys that same with the Sound Tigers that the guys played the full year, almost the year before in the NHL, and now they're back down. I remember playing back then. It was Binghamton was the farm team of the Ottawa Senators. And they had Spezza, they had Volchenkov, Chris Neal. I think Kelly was there. So they had a lot of great players. So you had that around the league. So the level was really high. And for us, you know, I was lucky enough, like with the Sound Tigers, I think they had me and Chris Campoli as the young guys coming in. So they had us play together. We played a ton. We played against the best lines. We played power play, PK. So it was a tremendous learning experience because the level was so high. But, you know, you're talking about talent players. I remember going into Binghamton, which is like a feels like a smaller rink. I'm pretty sure it's smaller. The corners are like square. It's dark. And Chris Neal would play on the first line. So, and Chris Neal was just headhunting the whole game. So these games were a great learning experience as well, but a little tougher on the body. So I remember him running around and that was tough because you're there to cover, obviously, Spezza. But then when the puck gets dumped in, it's a big bus going in and trying to get it. So those were learning experience. I had to learn the hard way, but it was a fun year.
So you come up in the 2005-2006 season, midway through the year for the Islanders. Then I guess it must have been a couple of years into your Islander tenure because you at one point described essentially a frat house that you lived in. Guys like Kyle Okposo, Josh Bailey, Tim Jackman, Nate Thompson. And also, I guess Nate Thompson had a black lab that lived in the house as well. What were some memories like in that place?
A lot of good memories, a lot of great memories. It was fun. It started with it was supposed to be me, Blake Como, and Kyle Okposo that lived together. But then, you know, training camp hits. And that year, I think Blake Como got sent down. And we picked up Nate Thompson on waivers. And I think Tomer got there. And the day he got there, I think he's born like 2 days after me. in October. He was drafted, I think, two spots or one spot right after me, right before me. So we're right next to each other. And we hit it off right away. And I think that day, like, I told him, like, hey, Tomer, like, me and Oki are going to look at places. You want to come? And he jumped on board. So there was the three of us. We got a place for the three of us. But then Jacko, like Tim Jackman, was getting called up. But actually, first, it was Josh Bailey, because that's the year that Josh Bailey got drafted and made the team out of camp as a young rookie, first rounder. So we took the young guy with us. And then during that year, Tim Jackman got called up and ended up staying. So we had another bedroom that was free. So he jumped in there. Tomer had his black lab, Diesel, that lived with us, that got in great shape that year, because every time we come back from practice, we each took turn throwing the ball back in the, you know, in the backyard and make him run. But it was fun. Not a lot of furniture in that place, because you had the beds in the bedrooms. I think we had a couch, a TV, and a pool table. That's about it. And a ping pong table, sorry. But we, a couple team events there, a couple good pranks were pulled in that, you know, a couple of fun nights, but it was a fun year.
We bring up Josh Bailey living in that house with you. And I wanted to ask, you know, what were your early impressions of Josh Bailey? Of course, you know, he's going to be hitting the 1,000 game mark. He probably will actually have already hit it by the time this podcast comes out. So for a guy that's still playing today, 1,000 games with the Islanders, just what do you remember about his arrival and early years with the team?
Awesome guy. Awesome family. Like, we got, you know, obviously to hang out a lot. We did the dad's trip. His parents would come down. And it, obviously, like, you're the parents of an 18-year-old that just makes it to the NHL and is going to go live on his own in New York. It's going to be tough for the parents as well, but they were awesome. It was so fun to see them. So the entire family, just amazing people. They're just so nice. So and we had a ton of fun with him. You could see that, like, just talent-wise, how smart he sees the game, because he's obviously, like, he wasn't the fastest. He wasn't the strongest. He didn't have the best shot, but everything together with his understanding of the game and how he saw things just made him a special player. So he's one of those, like, even if the league is changing, like, he can adjust because he's so smart on the ice. And it was a blast. It was a blast. And we didn't feel like he was an 18-year-old. Like, he was mature for what he had and what he brought and everything else. But it was fun to hang out and see the family come down.
Another teammate of yours from the early days, even going back into Bridgeport, would have been your goaltender, Wade Dubowitz. And so it took him a little while to make his mark in the National Hockey League, but he did it in a big way in 2007. And I believe you actually missed a good chunk of the end of that 06-07 year when the team made the run to the playoffs. But thanks to the heroics of Doobie, you got to come back for the postseason series against the Buffalo Sabres. Can you just share what Wade Dubowitz was like as a teammate and getting to see him make his mark that is still felt today, 15 years later, with the New York Islanders?
He was a great competitor. Like, he was a really small goalie, but he just, the way he competed, like, every day, he was an awesome guy, like, such a fun locker room presence. You know, sometimes you say, like, their goalies are a little different. They're in their own bubble. It wasn't the case for him. He was fun to be around, always joking around, and so nice with his defensemen. Always talking, always communicating, you know, help you out. If you did a bad turnover and they ended up scoring, he'd be the first one to say, oh, man, sorry, I should have stopped that. I should have helped you out there. So he was the nicest. He had some different habits for the diet or for what you think about a professional athlete. Before and during games and stuff like that. That always made it interesting, but he was an awesome guy and so much fun to be around. And he took, like, as a goalie and everything that he did, like, so humble, and everything that he would do for, you know, his defenseman. And he's one of those guys, especially when I first came in year AHL in 04-05, like, that's where I met him, and he was the goalie, and he was awesome goalie, really good. To see him kind of make it and have this impact in the NHL was awesome. But he was so nice to us, so nice to the defenseman. And when you're a young defenseman starting your pro career and you have a goalie like that, like, talking to you nonstop, that you can hang out with, you know, telling you stuff. And, like, I learned a ton from Wade Dubowitz, and it was awesome to be able to, you know, break it into the pros with him. And when I saw him come up, and do the job with the Islanders and, you know, bring the team in the playoffs. And it was just so awesome to see.
Bruno, there are a lot of guys on that 2006-2007 team. I want to ask you about the Alexei Yashins, the Miro Shatans, but we have to jump forward to 2007-2008, and there is one game I want to ask you about. That is November 3rd, 2007. That is Al Arbour night. Of course, Al Arbour coming back to coach his 1,500th game with the Islanders. You guys rally out of a 2-0 hole for a dramatic win, so what do you remember about Al Arbour and Al Arbour night?
That was Pittsburgh, if I believe.
It was. Yeah. Miro Shatan with the game-winning goal.
It was special. But that was Ted Nolan was our coach then. And it shows a lot about Ted Nolan because he was behind a lot of it, giving the opportunity to Al Arbour to come back and do his 1,500 game. Because obviously you're in a world where you need to win every night and every night's so important and everything like that. And he made that about him. So Al Arbour had a chance. Like, he talked with us before the game. He was on the bench, like, talking with us. And Ted Nolan did everything he could to make him comfortable and make him feel part of it and making sure that he was enjoying that night. Because it would have been easy for a coach to just do business as usual and kind of push him out of the way and do his thing and trying to win a game. He had him involved. He was talking to him, like, decision behind the bench. Like, he was involved in everything. And it made it so awesome. And Ted Nolan was phenomenal for that aspect and the human side of things and how much it has an impact of in bringing the best of your players, the best, you know, side of your players in those moments. And it's one of those where it was a special night. We all knew it. Ted Nolan did a tremendous job making it, like, really special and making sure that Al Arbour and everyone could enjoy it. And, you know, you just didn't want to end up with a loss on this night. It was too special. So it's one of those awesome night that you're part of. I remember having the jersey, the Al's jersey with the 1500 patched on it. But it was a special night. But one thing that really hit me was how much Ted Nolan made sure it was about Al Arbour and him enjoying it more than anything else. And that made just that rally the team around that.
Well, I can't believe we're coming up on the 15th anniversary of that already. But like you said, it looked like a really special night from everything we've heard. You know, another one of those nights I'm sure you probably remember in your career was the fight night against the Pittsburgh Penguins. And from what we understand, you know, you're friends with Max Talbot, and there may have been a little bit of a encounter after the game. And, you know, of course, everyone has a different story from that night. We talked to Michael Grabner. He's pretty proud of the fact he scored a couple of goals. We just talked to Michael Haley, who 32 minutes in penalties, fights a goalie, scores his first goal. What are your memories from fight night? Because it seems like everyone's got a story.
Well, I still talk about it to this day because of what you just said with Max Talbot. But if I go back, like, Max and I are friends since we're 10 years old. And obviously, he was a little bit of a target that night. Because a couple games before that, he actually ended up hitting Blake Como, which to this day, I keep telling him it was a dirty hit. He should have been suspended. And he still thinks it was a good hit. So we still battle on that. And I think that was the game we had the fight with Johnson and DiPietro. That was in Pittsburgh. So there's a setup. And then I remember that day coming in, and you could see there was a couple call-ups. You could see the lineup. With all the players that you had in the lineup, you just looked at it as like, oh, that's going to be a night. So you had that feeling. But it was on February 11th. And that's the day Max Talbot was born. It was his birthday. And we had a tradition while we were in the NHL. We always, you know, gave each other gifts, whatever, for our birthdays. And usually it was a good bottle of scotch that we could, you know, share together and enjoy. And I had a gift for him that I was going to give him after the game. But then the game went the way it went. Max had actually family in the stands for that game, and he just, you know, took off. And with all the events, and every time you look left, there was a fight, gloves. Max, I think, got jumped three times. Then you had the goalie fight. Eric Goddard playing is a, you know, old team, had to jump on the ice to go after Haley, who was going after the goalie Johnson that fought DiPietro a couple games before. So it was big, and we actually ended up, like, obviously the fact that we kept scoring goals. And we blew them out of the water with 9-2 and all those fights. And, you know, we had a really tough lineup. It made it like a night where I'm sure for Pittsburgh, it felt it would never end. But it was a crazy night. And You had the Trevor Gillies, you had the Konopka, Haley. Like, the lineup was just so tough. And Haley, you know, knocking out Adams and they defied the corner. Everything that happened, everything was one-sided. And it, obviously for Talbot, it was a tough one. He fought, I think, that day, like Martin, Konopka, and Haley. So three really tough customers, way above his weight class. So it was a tough night. So I remember after the game, I was like, damn, I got to go give him his gift, right? And we usually see each other after the game. So I made my way on the other side, really, you know, trying not to see anybody because I'm sure they weren't happy on this side. And I see his face and just he's got red marks all over it, like, you know, scratching everything. And he looks at me, he's like, so I got his gift. Like, are you f-ing serious? You gotta walk over here and give me a gift? Like, man, sorry. Happy birthday, bro. So that was a tough night, and we still talk about it and once in a while, and we have that debate. But yeah, it's one of those nights where it was nuts.
But your stat line that night, you had an assist, a career high and game high for anybody in that game, but +4 rating. And zero penalty minutes. So at least he couldn't blame you for anything that may have happened.
I remember I fought a couple of weeks before. I fought Colin White, and that was a really bad idea. He broke my face really good. So I ended up playing that game with a fishbowl. So I remember they kept having scrums everywhere and, like, fights breaking out everywhere. But I just had a broken cheekbone. And my trainer, Garrett Timms at the time, every time I get back to the bench, he's like, Bruno, don't you do it. Don't you do it. And I wasn't a fighter anyway. I wasn't much of a fighter. But it's one of those nights where you feel like everyone wants to be part of the dance, right? Part of the party. I felt like left alone a little bit. But, yeah, it was one of those where I had the fishbowl. So every scrum, guys that didn't want to fight would come and grab me because they knew it was a safe zone, safe area.
Well, there was also a piece of media I remember from those days, a video that the team put together where you went to a pizza shop and were a chef for a day, learned how to make a pizza. Do you remember that? And do you remember anything about those pizza making skills you may have learned that day?
But there was a couple like that. I remember the pizza one. I remember going to it was a restaurant in Middlebrook, the old City Cellar that we used to go to. I don't know if it's still there or still exists.
Yep, but still there.
Yeah, we used to go to a lot, and the people there were awesome to us and to our, you know, our wives, girlfriends, families, and everything like that. So a lot of it, we'd go there after games quite a bit. And I actually ended up doing a cooking show too as well there, like for fun, where, you know, a little meal that I like to prep, and I would go there. We did it in the kitchen, and we prepared it, cooked it, and everything, and tasted it after. So we did one there as well. So it's one thing that I always liked. My role with, you know, usually when I had one roommate my first year too, even if I had roommates here in the off season, I was the cook. Part of it was my deal was I cook, you clean. So I got out of cleaning the kitchen by doing that. A lot of fun. But yeah, I did a couple of these shows or a little cooking show for fun. But yeah, the pizza one and then this one at City Cellar. This one at City Cellar was fun because it was really like prep a meal. What do you want? What do you need? And trying to build a recipe out of that. So that was cool.
Well, it seems like a pretty good segue to go into your TV career. And of course, you've been an analyst on RDS, which I'm from Vancouver, so I'm more familiar with the TSN and, you know, the fact that RDS seems like it's the French TSN. But how did you get into broadcasting? I mean, how did you wind up making the jump from playing to becoming an analyst over at RDS?
When I was about 23, it starts there. When I was 23 years old, I started having knee problems, and it got bad and worse and worse and worse real fast, to the point where that summer I stopped working out. It was about I'd say like June 20th or something like that. I stopped working out because my daily decisions were based on how many stairs I had to go, you know, up from or down, because, you know, every time I went up the stairs or down the stairs, it was dangerous. I had a knee that kept giving out, and then the second one started doing the same thing, and we couldn't, you know, put their finger on the problem. I ended up having a hip surgery and a knee surgery trying to fix it, never did. So it got so bad that I stopped working out and I started writing my retirement speech. I was like, I had a contract with the Islanders, but for me, I thought it was done. Like, I couldn't move, I couldn't skate, I couldn't train, I couldn't do anything. So I was at that point, I was lucky enough that Pierre Allard actually ended up working with the Canadians, and now he's overseas in Munich. but he was a good friend of mine. He was my trainer, and he's the one that didn't throw the towel. He said, no, I'm going to find people to surround you. And then he almost like convinced me to get back because I was so afraid. I was in a dark place. And I was at the time in the summers, I would live with Max Talbot actually. And he saw me like I was in a dark place. And Pierre actually got two people to work with me, Hugo Santomo, which is who's a doctor in Serge Savoie, who's he was helping him out, you know, training us. And they just got on my, you know, trying every day they would work with me, start from the basics. Like every training I did was, you know, with manual resistance. Almost I felt like learning to walk again. And we got to the point, things got a little better, but just good enough to show up to camp. And, you know, trying to, you're a pro athlete, you're trying to, you don't want to show weakness. So at that point for me, I didn't want to talk about it. So I kept that for myself, but I was nowhere near what you should have been in, you know, NHL training camp. But that year, like survived a little bit, you know, obviously I try to play as good as I can. Over there in the NHL. But that summer when I came back, I had an opportunity here with RDS, and they offered me to do a couple like, you know, playoff games and stuff like that in between periods. And every time they asked, I said yes. Even though it was late at night, I said yes and yes and asked for more and asked for more, because I knew like every year I did from that point on was like a bonus year. I was like, oh, can I do another one? Is it going to come back? Is it going to go so bad that I can't do anything? So for me, I asked for more. I did more and as much as possible, because I saw that as a safety net maybe, or a bridge to what's going to be next. And I wanted to keep it as long as I was playing. So I did more and more. I did games. I did shows. I was asking for more. So I really learned everything that was involved with this as much as possible, got to know the people, got to know RDS and everything. So actually I was lucky enough that I ended up being 10 years later when I retired. So I'd had an extra bonus 10 years, which is good. But even before I retired, I had an offer on the table to make that permanent and make that, you know, a steady thing. And I knew I liked it, but I didn't know I was going to like it that much. It's such a fun gang over there. So we have so much fun doing this. And I'm lucky enough to be covering the Rocket, which is the AHL team, the Canadians, the Sens, the league, the, you know, everything else. I'm involved in hockey, involved in different projects. That's not about hockey. So, which is fun, but this is how everything started over there.
Well, Bruno, I know that you worked for RDS and Mike Bossy worked for TVON. Obviously a lot of us are still processing and grieving Mike's loss last year. Just as an Islander alumni, or perhaps, you know, an interaction on the TV side, just wondering if you ever had any, you know, interactions or memories with Mike Bossy.
Obviously, these guys were around a lot, and I think it meant a lot, and it still means a lot to the organization to have these guys from the dynasty around the team a lot. And we had a chance to, like, I was close with Clark Gillies and Mike Bossy, and like with Mr. Gillies, like his golf tournament, I made my way. I made a point to go as much as possible to his events. He was a tremendous person and such a great leader and example. Ryan Trottier was the same way. There was so many of them around. And when Mike Bossy came, every time, obviously, like I was the, you know, the French Canadian. So we got to talk, we got to hang out. I remember some like those, you know, kickoff golf tournament, kickoff the season. They were there, so we'd sit at the same table and we talked for you know, a long time. And he actually, you know, he would come to the rink once in a while. So just to see him around, and I got the chance, it was an honor to see him quite a bit. You know, that was awesome. That was really good to see such an alumni, such a legend, and to be able to share his change and talk with him.
I wanted to also ask, because you got to play in Europe a couple different times in your career, and in the 12-13 lockout, you participated in the Spengler Cup in Switzerland. And a few weeks ago, we actually had Benoit Hogue on, and he also a former Islander from Quebec who in his career got to play in the Spengler Cup, and wanted to just ask your memories of that tournament. And again, similar to the AHL question earlier, because that was another lockout year, so you had some NHL talent that was able to participate that typically wouldn't be there. Guys like Patrick Kane and Joe Thornton, I saw, were a part of that tournament.
There was a lot of talent there. I was playing with Fribourg-Gotteron, the team. So Christian Dubé, which is now the manager, but he was playing at the time. and the GM there. He was playing. I remember we had David Desharnais, Max Talbot, Corey Schneider, and Patrick Hornqvist that were there on that team. It was such a great experience. During that lockout, it was a crazy lockout because during that lockout, Talbot and I started the Players Tour. And we built something that we just blew up really fast, got really big really fast. We were raising money for foundations around Quebec and try to get the guys together, play some games, and give back to the fans. That was the goal. It got to a point at some point we're negotiating, we're talking with different TV station and, you know, talking with different groups across the world. We had a group in Czech Republic and we talked to in Kelowna, I think, in Minnesota and Toronto, like to play some games and create something. And that just went, like, that blew up fast. But that was a lot of work because it was Max and I and a couple of friends that we had around us helping us out. So we got to a point where it was getting hard. And it was like, all right, like there was rumors that we're going to start playing again. So he's like, all right, like we better focus on that first. So I had my friend Joe Bernier that was playing in Germany somewhere. So he brought me there. I played there a little bit. And we had, you know, from the guys that were in Europe, some teams would ask, you know, if they have tournaments, stuff like that. So Fribourg-Gotteron was one of them. And they asked us to go. So played for about a month in Germany in the second league. And then went to Switzerland to skate with that team for a little bit. And ended up playing that tournament. It was a blast. It was a blast. Davos is such a nice city. And it's a tournament. You want the best, but it felt like teams just wanted to make it to the semifinals. And it was one of those feelings where, all right, like you want to make sure that you're not the first team out of the tournament and then you can have fun. So that was a little bit of what I got from that anyway. So the players, as soon as we made it to the semifinal, we're playing, you know, Team Canada in the semis. But then as soon as you qualified for the semis, it was like, all right, time to celebrate. It's the holidays. Let's go. So guys went skiing. So we had some parties and stuff like that. So it was a blast. Tough game against Canada because they had a hell of a team. I think Duchesne and Tavares and these guys were on there. So they had a good team, but lost in the semis. And what I got from that is that it was the best case scenario because then the guys got to enjoy and spend some time there. So it was a fun team. So much fun to be around and just a nice little refresher. And for me, it was a great experience in Europe, which I knew I wanted to keep some space for that at the end of my career. And living this, just make it official. It's like, well, before like my body quits on me, I want to make sure I go back and I live an experience like that in Europe.
And you did get to play a couple of years in Berlin before you hung up the skates. But Bruno, you've been very gracious with your time. We thank you and we hope to see you at an alumni weekend, possibly at UBS Arena later this year.
Oh, I can't wait. And that's one thing though, with like the new management of the team and everything that's going on, like the fact that they're bringing back the alumni program and, you know, making the alumni proud and involved, it's awesome. And I made it once, obviously with the pandemic and everything and everything that went down. And now with a young family, three kids, it's not always easy, but it's so much fun when we make it down there to see all the guys and get to hang out and see that's one thing though. I haven't seen the arena yet. So I want to make sure I am going to be coming, and I got a son that's 9 years old now. He's going to be coming obviously. And we want to make that a little family trip and enjoy and go back to, you know, live a lot of good memories I had along Island.
Well, thank you again for joining us on another edition of Talkin' Isles. Please make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you might listen. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at Greg Picker here.
And I'm at Rightsway.
You can follow all the latest info about the team on Twitter at NY Islanders and stay up to date on UBS Arena at ubsarena.com. A big thank you to our producer, Rachel Lusher, and to WRAQ at Hofstra University. And we'll see you next time on Talkin' Isles.